interview with Mr. Alva F. Lyons of Durango, Colorado on June the 25th, 1982. The other person talking is Robert W. Delaney, Director of the Center of Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College. What we are mainly trying to determine are things regarding railroads, and especially the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad, which ordinarily do not appear in the records. Now, the first thing I'm going to try to get down is some personal background of Mr. Lyons. Mr. Lyons, you want to go through this first, when you were born, your parents, your family, in other words.
Well, Robert, I was born February the 28th, 1897, in Durango, Colorado. My parents were Isaiah John Lyons and Margaret Ann Gabe. The Gabe family were pioneers in this area to come here in 84. My grandfather worked
Alva, that Gabe is spelled G-A-B-B-E, right? Okay.
Yes. And they were pioneers. Also, my father was here in the early days in 1892. He first arrived in Leadville, Colorado, and worked for the Denver and Rio Grande in 1884. He resigned there and moved to the UP, or the Oregon Short Line that run from Ogden to Anaconda. And he worked for there till 1896, when he was dismissed because the engineer run over a short rail and derailed the engine.
They blamed him, is that right?
That's evidently what they did.
Yes.
He was dismissed without prejudice. You know,
tell me what that means.
That means that any employee that's discharged by the blacklist so that they can't get a job on another railroad.
Now, is this why people changed their names so that that blacklist wouldn't apply to them? They'd go someplace else and get work on another railroad, is that right?
That is right.
Or another mine in case of a mine.
Any place that
he was dismissed without prejudice.
Yes,
which meant that they would have hired him back had there been a physician.
Yes.
Okay.
He then went to work for the Montana Railroad, which is the run between Butte and Anaconda. Started in as a night yard master, and then he was in just a few months or years, he was appointed general yard master over both the Anaconda and the Butte yards. Then turned around and resigned those two, or that main position, and went to run as a conductor.
I see.
Between Butte and Montana.
Alva, tell me, what are the duties of a yard master? What's he in charge of?
He's in charge of all the yard operations, the switch engines, making up trains, how to do it, when to do it, and call the trains and set them out at the right
time. He's likely to work all night.
Well, he works 12 hours a day.
12 hours. 12 hours.
Yeah.
And then there's somebody else takes over.
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually they have the day yard master takes over the night.
And a night yard master. Okay.
Yeah. He arrived after he quit the Montana Railroad. He resigned there. And then he come back to Durango. And I always thought, he never did say so. He arrived here in 1892, he started in as the yard master in Durango. And always thought because of the smelter at Leadville, evidently had problems with the ore that come in and could never be switched at the right place at the right time. So that was why he was evidently come to Durango.
Because he had some knowledge he wanted.
He had some way how to do it. My history of the of my father is that he was a very good wrecker.
What do you mean by wrecker?
Well, re-railing cars.
Re-railing them.
Yes.
Putting them back on.
Putting back on.
Okay.
and things like that. The other thing he was good at was public relations with the people he worked with, as well as the customers of the railroad. Because they would, normally you would go through the agent in a freight house. And
yeah.
He would put out an order then for the yard crew to do this. Well, here in Durango, as far as I can remember, the customer went to my father. And he would tell him when he would be there. After all, in Durango at that time, we had the passenger train east. We had when it come from Silver, that section of the train that led east didn't need to be turned. But the other cars in the train had to be turned on the turntable, because there was no Y or circle to complete the round trip, turning of the train.
There was no Y down there.
No Y.
Each individual car had to be turned
on
that turntable.
On the turntable.
It's still there.
Still there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, he did that for many years. Then he was a joker. Sometimes he'd lost one of his fingers in the Lincoln pin coupling.
Is this the coupling between two railroad cars?
Between two railroad cars where they have a joint.
Yes.
With two pins that go down into it.
And that's why so many railroadmen had a thumb gone or a finger gone?
That's right.
And I think, do you know what was the standard procedure if you got a finger cut off, a claim against the railroad? Do you know how much they paid?
Not very much.
No?
Not very much. And sometimes they'd send them to the doctor and they might pick up the claim, and sometimes not.
Not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, depending on who you were and where.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the other thing was that he had an eye injury at some time, and so he had a glass eye. Well, he was always betting with fellas that he could look at the sun longer than anybody else.
Sure.
And I can always remember Ellis Roberts, who was an engineer, just a block from where we did on 4th Avenue. He bet him $5 that he could look, so, and he did. He looked at that sun with that glass eye, and had old Roberts couldn't see for 2 days.
Sure.
After he would look.
Yeah.
Well, that was just one of the things. The other one, he was very handy with a snowball. Just a soft snowball, and some of those stuffed shirts had come out of the depot. And he happened to be around, and the snow was just right. He'd pitch a snowball over and either hit him in the back of the neck or on top of those derby hats that they wore at those times. And it was really laughable all those years.
Good. Okay, go ahead.
I actually followed in the same footsteps of my father, because I was always in trouble in school. On the same way, I was that kind of a fellow. Went to work on the railroad. He joined the Masonic Lodge, I did. And he was interested in all the other things that I have been. He was very as a labor representative, he was with the Order of Railway Conductors in Durango at that time, which covered the Rio Grande Southern Railroad. Well, he was the president of the division here.
Yeah.
And he took care of all the cases. Things of that kind.
Did your careers on the Denver and Rio Grande overlap?
No, not necessarily, except for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
From 1915, when I went to work, until he died in 1923.
I see.
Yeah.
Your father died in 1923.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, we come down here. We had three children in that family. Myself as the oldest, and my sister Mary next in line. And then Sister Gladys. And Gladys is the only one that worked during the railroad, because Father became sick somewhere in the 20s, around 21 or anything, and he didn't do very much work, but she worked in the roundhouse.
I see.
As a typist and clerk over
yes.
there.
Are these sisters still living, your sisters?
Just one is living in Colorado Springs.
In what is her married name?
Her married name is Roberts. E.R. Roberts was a salesman for Minus Miller Supply.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. E.R. Roberts.
Uh-huh.
And do they have children?
They have a boy and a girl.
What are their names?
Well, Eddie Roberts is the boy, and the daughter was Barbara Roberts, and she was in school work, but she died of cancer here several years ago.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, in my own family, we had one child, the wife and I, and that's a daughter, Martha Ann.
And where does she live?
She lives at Cincinnati at the present time, the wife of a professor of chemistry at the University of Cincinnati.
Yes.
And they were both graduates of the Antioch College at Yellow Springs, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And they both had an experience working while they were getting their education.
Mm-hmm.
She worked for the Army evaluating tests for recruits or people to become officers and such like as that.
Mm-hmm.
And also worked for an insurance company in Chicago as an actuary, which she was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, your own education. You were born in Durango and you went to school in Durango.
I was born in Durango. I went to school in Durango, the same as my mother, my wife, and my daughter.
So four generations.
Four generations.
Of your family has gone to school here in Durango.
Graduated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Graduated from high school.
From high school.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
I then went to took 1 year at the University of Colorado, studying mechanical engineering.
Yeah.
But the due to the World War I coming along, I expected to be called. When I was working at the railroad, had seniority all this time, and when I come back to Durango, I expected to be called to the Army, so I didn't go back to college. In fact, I was earning my own way to go to school anyway. And I worked then that year, and then in 1918, in the early fall, just either August or September, I don't know when they called me in August. And in September, then I was inducted in the, back in the...
Where'd you go to be inducted?
Well, I went into Camp Riley in Kansas.
Yeah.
And I got the flu there. Before I, 2 days after I got out of the hospital, they transferred me to Indianapolis to, what's the fort there?
Fort Wayne?
No.
I don't know.
Oh, well, it doesn't make any difference.
No,
anyway, I went from there to a, I got flu and then I didn't, I couldn't carry a pack and I shouldn't have been going anyway, but then I went from that way in about a week. Friends carried the pack for me. I went to Camp Humpton and then across to France.
Yeah. And in France, what unit were you a part of?
I was with the 35th Engineers in France.
Would this be what we call combat engineers today?
No.
Well,
we were a car building.
Railroad car building.
Railroad car building.
So your old railroading caught up with you.
Yeah, caught right back into it. I expected to be in the train service.
Yeah.
Being a trainman, but
sure.
It seemed like the people that were office people or worked in... around the roundhouse or around the car shops or all laborers, well, they went to trainmen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was...
And you a trainman?
I a trainman.
Wonder they didn't make a cook of you.
Well, they could have. But it was something that I was handy with because I was always
sure.
Studied manual training, so I fit in there right away, right quick.
Good. Okay, and you weren't in any battles, any actual
battles. Battle,
because that wasn't
no.
Your function.
No.
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 And when did you return then to the United States?
In May of 1919.
Did you join the American Legion over there in Paris at post number one
no.
Or here when you came home?
No, I didn't join the American Legion here until 1928.
Mm. 1928, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I know you've been an officer in the Legion. We'll get back to that a little later on. Okay, now... we've got your father and your mother and your family, except I don't have your wife's name on this tape.
Her name is Mercedes.
Mercedes, okay. And we've got your education. Now, tell us, getting into the railroading, tell us why... you think, and I think it's necessary to make this tape.
Well, after my long experience of trying to convince and explain why local people and that I mean by local people, that's the shippers on the railroad, must fight to protect their interest in the service they use, provided by a public carrier. This would apply to stock raisers, farmers, smelters, coal and ore mines, and the general public represented by council or organizations or public officials. I found this necessary because of a reporter from Good Morning America could not understand why I was so interested in doing this very thing. So that's where I couldn't explain to him that the management of the railroad was interested in their main line operations rather than in a branch line service, particularly when it's marginal like it was in this area.
In this area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your point is then that the Denver and Rio Grande, the management of the Denver and Rio Grande, was interested in that main line through the Arkansas Valley and out that way, and not so much in these so-called branch lines or feeder lines, whatever they might
be.
Because, as you say, it was a marginal, maybe, operation.
Well, in the early days, when Palmer started here, that was what he was building, was feeder lines, so he could possibly extend those feeder lines, like south into New Mexico, or clear west, or even north, because they'd like to have a better route to the west than coming down through Pueblo.
Yes.
That day.
Mm-hmm. And your point is, too, that a lot of things that the management wanted in abandonment proceedings and bankruptcies and things like that don't appear in the official records.
Well, if they do, they go into an attorney's office.
Yeah.
Or they go into the ICC or the PUC, and there's nobody going to go into those records.
And people then doing research on railroads and looking strictly at management's records are not going to get absolutely the true story.
That's
is this
right.
correct?
Absolutely
okay.
right.
Then, now, I'd like to go back to your early years of railroading. Let's take the first 10 years. You started in 1915. You had some time out, a little bit of college, and you had a war in there. And what else transpired in that first 10 years of your career as a railroad? Because your seniority goes back to 1915. Is this
That's
not
right.
true? Yeah, okay.
Well, I started working for the railroad the day I graduated from high school as a B&B helper.
What's a V&B helper?
Well, you do all the hard work on a bridge gang, shoveling.
When they say, hey, you, that's what?
Hey, you, that's jump in there. You're okay. on the wrong end of a saw all the time.
Okay.
And things.
What
like
does V&B stand for?
Bridge and building.
Oh, B&B, bridge
yeah.
and building.
Building,
okay.
Bridge and building.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you started on that on a work group.
I started on that, and I learned down here right in Durango, there's one section of a bridge there that they have the same one span on the north end of the bridge crossing the Animas River that we built there while I was in there. Those were replaced from some old time.
Yeah.
And they were strictly timbers, and we sawed the carpenter measured them out, and we sawed them out, and he adds them out to fit so that they were all. Ordinarily, they do that in the sawmills now, and they come here all ready to set up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was a good experience for me to see how this thing was done.
Sure. So at first you're on work. Did you go out every morning, come back every night ordinarily?
Well, while we were working in Durango on these bridges, we did that. I stayed in town, and I went out with a crew every morning.
Yes.
The minute that we moved to Hermosa, we put in that bridge up there, the same kind, and those two cement piers are still there after that since 1915, and I'm sure I shoveled a good share of that cement, mixing them by a shovel on a platform.
Right.
Mm-hmm. From there on, when we moved from there out to Florida and built a bridge at Oxford that the engineer McCabe run into on the Packer train, and it was badly damaged, so we had to fix that up.
I see. Why did he run into it?
Well, couldn't see it, I guess.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was damaged.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay, getting back, what after your start there as a workman on the work crew building bridges and buildings, How did you get into actual train operation?
Well, I went to college that fall.
Yeah, okay.
And when I come back next spring, I hired out as a brakeman right away.
Okay, and what? Tell me what a brakeman does.
A brakeman, he does the flagging. If he's a rear brakeman, he flags the train. And if they do any, in other words, he's the guy that works the field. Like in a switching operation, you have the three men. The head man handles the engine. He takes the engine on and off the train or goes through it, takes it to the cut of cars. The field man does the other work out there, set the hand brakes and such things as that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I worked then all that next summer. And I thought, well, there's no use going back to college because I'll then be going to the Army. So I
did you work right here in these yards?
I worked here in these yards. And a lot of the work I did was on the Silverton branch because they were rebuilding a snow shed up there, a slide shed.
All right, where?
And, well, that's at 492 and a half. That's this side of Silverton.
Right this side of Silverton, 4 miles, okay.
And you didn't like to work up there. The older men who would ordinarily be on the passenger. So I got up as an extra man. I kept up there and up there working on that train because we would bring the rock that was loaded on the side of the hill there. We'd shove those flat cars with rock into Silverton, and then next morning, we'd have to bring them down back of the passenger train and spot them in this section of track there where they were building the shed.
Yes.
Use the rock then to build a crib.
Right. Yes.
Well, they didn't like that. So I was on the Silverton there with Jim Feeney for, I don't know how long anyway, for a month or so.
Mm-hmm.
One day I come back from Silver. They called me to Deadhead East, to Alamosa. I got to Alamosa that night.
Tell me what you mean by deadheading.
Well, they called me to ride the train over there. That's
okay.
All they call it, a deadhead trip.
Okay.
And we got paid for those kind
sure.
of trips.
All right.
So much. We got to Alamosa. I was called and within an hour to take a go with the freight train to Levita, standard gauge. I was in a passenger uniform. No clothes, and not a sign of anything else. Well, at the time, there was Bill Herrick had left the store here, Nathan Herrick's store,
yes.
Started one of his own over there. He was down at the depot. I saw him, and I knew him very well. So I went up and got overalls and supplied gloves and one thing and another so I could work. Well, I worked over there for 2 weeks. I finally got tired of him and told him I was going back home because I didn't have enough clothes. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked all over there on the standard gauge for all of that time.
Yeah. What else happened in between 1915 and 1925?
Well, we've had the... there was a lot of things that happened during that year. The railroad was in a very precautious position because of the... using the money, the revenue that was generated by particularly the narrow gauge at that time with ore shipments and other things, it was used to build the Western Pacific. And so the maintenance of the rolling stock on our railroad here was going downhill.
Yes.
So...
Now, the Western Pacific was owned by the same people that owned the Denver and Rio Grande that time. And they are trying to build up the Western Pacific, and they're running down the Denver and Rio Grande in order to build up.
Yes.
They're taking the rolling stock, motive power, and things like that?
Well, they didn't take any of that because they used their own.
Okay.
Yes. But
they just let this run down.
It was running down.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And, by the way, was the Denver and Rio Grande under the control of the United States during World War I, the same as the Railroad Authority? Yeah.
They had a number of vice presidents come in about that time, and Brown and Baldwin were the two receivers, Brown being the president before the receivership. Baldwin come in then to help him. And then's when the Reconstruction Finance Corporation took over and operated all the railroads of the United States.
All right.
And that's when we got the 8-hour day
changed
instead of the 10-hour day. They got a wage scale that was better. They arranged it so that it was arranged on 100 miles a day for freight and 150 miles a day for passenger.
What, ordinarily, how long did that take, the 100 miles, let's say, on freight?
In our place, 100 miles here with freight would probably take about 10 hours.
About 10 hours, okay. Mm-hmm. And passenger, of
the
course,
passenger
much less.
About 10 hours from Durango to Alamosa, which was made a long trip.
Was that a 10-hour trip?
That was a 10-hour trip.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people imagine that 100 miles, you know, it doesn't sound like much.
No, not really.
It sounds like feather bedding, you
yes.
see, to a lot of people.
Yes.
I just wanted to get that in, okay.
Yeah.
Well, now, it was under that, under the United States, under that railroad authority.
Yes.
So, this receivership, was this because of a bankruptcy at all?
They were all bankruptcy proceedings because they had to go, to keep the railroad intact, then they had to go bankrupt.
Yeah.
At that time. And that meant then that the creditors of the railroad were getting in the driver's seat, and things commenced to change then.
So they go to bankruptcy to keep the creditors from selling whatever had been put up as collateral.
Yes.
It's true that the railroads put up part of the rolling stock, property, things like that as collateral for loans.
That's right.
If they didn't have the money to pay, the bankers could sell this.
That's right.
Okay. Now, these bankruptcies then, you see, that explains, I think I haven't gotten in there. Do you know who were the controlling interests of the Western Pacific and the Denver and Rio Grande? What family?
The Gould family.
The Gould.
Yeah.
Of the old Jay Gould
and
that. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And they were, of course, within competition with the Harrimans and I forget who it was now in the Southern Pacific.
Well, Huntington and Crocker.
Huntington, Hawker, and all of
Crocker,
them.
And I've forgotten the other.
Yeah,
Hollis P. Huntington,
yeah.
Crocker. Same people who built the Central Pacific out to meet up with the Union Pacific.
Yeah.
Yes. All right.
So that's the...
And, of course, he's interested in building up the Gould now. Is interested in building up the stock of the Western Pacific Railroad so it'll sell higher. And to do that... he's just letting the Denver and Rio Grande go down here.
Go down, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, Baldwin then turned around and was the president right after the receivership when the Reconstruction Finance turned back the railroad to private ownership.
I see. All right.
That lasted for... then Young come in, I think, is the next president. And... he tried to do something. In fact, he was a lot of the things that were going on here, particularly the surveying of a new right-of-way for the railroad from Alamosa to Durango to get away from Cumbry's Pass and some of the other bad spots on the railroad, like coming into Durango from Bosea up at the top of the hill here on 40 to Mesa.
Yeah.
Down from Monero down to Lumberton. They expected to take a canyon further north of there and bypass those places.
Yeah, and where were they going to come in? How were they going to come into Durango?
Well, the survey finally would have come in at Bondad, and then they would have joined up with the Farmington branch there and come into Durango.
Right, okay.
See, now they were surveying for a standard gauge railroad.
Yes.
Not narrow gauge, it just...
Do you know when that survey was made, or who the main surveyor was?
Well, I've forgotten his name, but
yeah.
I was a good friend of him.
Okay. Do you know who it was? Who?
Gwynn.
Looking back at the records, then a guy would... Well, the date would be probably be the easiest day.
Yeah.
Do you remember the dates when that survey was made about?
They were making, I think, in the 20s, probably up to 24 or something.
All
like
right.
That. Yeah.
And they're just trying to straighten out some of the curves and get a better grade and so on from Alamosa over here.
For a
standard gauge railroad.
Yes.
And did they intend to take that standard gauge clear up to Silverton?
No.
No?
No.
They intended to keep a narrow gauge.
They probably keep it narrow gauge.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, at that time, the Farmington branch, I want to get to that later, had become a narrow gauge.
At 1923.
Yes. Huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at the time of the survey. But they were going to keep part... part narrow gauge.
So it was before the farming branch was turned over to a narrow gauge. You see, they give that up.
Yes. All right.
See that. So that would be, that still comes into the time period there.
Yes, that's still in our 10-year period here that we're talking about. Do you think of anything else important that happened to this area right in here in the Denver and Rio Grande, say, before 1925?
Well, the getting a lot of stock off the reservation, sheep.
Business was booming.
Business really well. We couldn't handle it from Farmington to Durango and standard gauge equipment.
Yeah.
So the logical thing then would be asking the New Mexico PUC to rescind the order and let them change the rail to narrow gauge.
Yeah. You changed it completely. You didn't just put in a third rail.
No.
It wasn't so you could put standard gauge